Hello, welcome to the latest bonus episode of The Rest Is History. We meet, of course, my friends, in the wake of that landmark Winston Churchill impersonation. Tom Holland, I think, who tells me he's only running at about 80% today. That's because he's lost 20% in shock at the reaction to that world-class impersonation. And in particular, the very kind messages on Discord and on Twitter suggesting that Tom should perhaps listen back to it, listen to the role of the cadences to try and work on his own Mike Yarwood impersonation in future. That's right, isn't it, Tom?
No, it was an easy kill. I mean, anyone can do Churchill. It's the kind of the Frank Spencer of historical...
That will mean nothing to our overseas listeners.
No, it won't. But it's imagine the easiest impersonation you can do, and Churchill is that easiest impersonation. I'm afraid the real litmus test of quality is, can you do Liam Neeson pretending to be a CIA agent? Because there are whole kind of dimensions of complexity there that you simply don't get with Churchill. and I think that listeners will remember my groundbreaking impersonation of Richard Nixon reading the New York Times.
Yeah.
T.S. Eliot. I'm not taking this.
Well, your Neanderthal. Your Neanderthal was...
And my Neanderthal. Dominic... Dylan. I think, people have compared us to Lennon and McCartney, and I think that that's the way to see it, that it's the fusion of talent.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about one of us being better than the other
necessarily, as in impersonations.
It's about both of us are very clearly, we're clearly very, very talented at impersonations. And
one star, no less, for my impersonation of Thomas Beckett.
Yeah. Well, you've come on from then.
Yeah,
that was clearly kind of youthful development. I think that
with the Arnold Bennett
I feel no envy. I feel no envy at all. I'm happy for you, and I think it's to the benefit of the podcast.
I have to take these small victories, as you know.
So I agree. Well done on your Churchill. Very good. On the Discord channel.
Yes.
I think the major revelation has been that basically everyone on the Discord channel went to King's College London.
So this is on some sort of, this is an introduce yourself channel thing that started up on Discord, isn't it? Where people basically, they go on and they say...
I mean, even people in America or Australia seem to have gone to King's College London. It's
who they are. And the Discord community is very much where it's at, by the way. If you're a Rest Is History club member and you're not on it yet, you should be on it because they're all having great fun. As far as I can tell.
And
but as Tom says, a lot of them went to King's College London.
You're a visiting professor there, aren't you?
I am. And if somebody asked me about that, and the truth is I don't know. I feel bad saying this because I'm worried. Whenever I draw attention to it, King's College London will scrap it, and that will mean I lose my library card, which is, I mean, I've never set foot in a library, but I use it.
So you've never actually visited it, even though you're a visiting professor?
I went once in 20, but not either this or the previous decade.
that's a shocking indictment.
So that's quite a long time ago. Well, I mean, they seem to enjoy. I don't know what it is or what it means.
Very good. But anyway, so King's College London clearly seems to be where it's at on the Discord. And also, Tennis Court Sloth. What do you think?
Yeah.
He did some wonderful Rest Is History kind of drinking game bingo cards.
Tom, I need to pause 1 second because Arthur has answered the door to a stranger.
Goodness. Yeah. We mustn't have that.
Arthur? What's occurring?
So for Dominic's gone to check whether his son has opened the door perhaps to a vampire or a passing tinker. Who knows? Who it's going to turn out to be.
Right, back to the guitar, please.
Okay, here he's going to... So, Dominic, who was it?
One more go. Sorry, Tom. Sorry.
Dominic, the tension's been right. Who was it?
Amazon. Delivering
Amazon.
Books. It's Amazon. Delivering books about the Vikings.
Good. Okay, so that's maybe not as exciting as it could have been. I was holding out to the listeners that perhaps it was a vampire.
A vampire?
Is that an elaborate plug for your
your own novels?
Maybe it's the classic thing. You should never allow a vampire into your house.
Well, I mean, that would be a schoolboy error.
It would. And Arthur's a schoolboy, so that's why I was worrying. So back to the bingo cards. So,
Yes. Now, these are long-standing, aren't they?
Yes.
Some of these are quite dated references.
Yes.
Dogs. We haven't done a dog on the podcast for ages.
There was a whole stage where we were killing dogs, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Yachting shoes. They still pop up occasionally.
They do. Being shot while on the
Daily
toilet,
Mail reference. Yeah, that's.
They're not disparaging. I mean, they're admiring. If anything,
actually, surprisingly clear Christianity link. I think that's still going.
Tom plugs Dominion with dollar signs in his eyes. That one will never date.
So what would be more recent ones? Well, impersonations probably.
Yeah, we didn't do any impersonations in about the first 50 or 60 episodes. And they've now become much more of a theme, haven't they?
Mentions of Paddington.
Yeah.
Which I think actually, you know, if we're talking about the highlight of, I don't think it was your Churchill impression. I think it was the stunning revelation of the fact that you've been massively overinflating.
Yeah, by 100%.
The impact. Yes, by 100%. The impact that your
review had on the Scottish theatrical critic community.
So those who missed it, the Scotsman review was uncovered by Rebecca Stubbs, who I hope is listening to this, and I can't thank enough for having sent it to me, which revealed that Dominic had not got 2 stars for his performance as Beckett.
Well, hold on.
He got 1.
It was a review for the entire company.
Yeah, I know.
And a lot of the review was about offstage stuff like guitars falling over.
And the mime artist.
People, strangers gaining entrance to the
But it was the mime artist. That's, I mean, you can't do a play on the Edinburgh Fringe and not have a mime artist wandering.
But you've done it. Tom, have you not?
Yeah, I have. I did 2.
What did you do?
2 that I'd written.
You'd written?
Yeah.
What were they about?
One was about Joan of Arc. One was about Oscar Wilde.
Oh, right. Who did you play both leads, Joan of Arc and Oscar Wilde?
No, I directed them.
And how did they go down?
Very successfully, I think they
did. Did you get reviewed by a major newspaper?
I think we got 4 stars.
From what?
From the Scotsman.
I don't believe you.
I think we did. I mean, I haven't kept the review, so who knows?
Oh, how convenient.
Anyway, we've had some lovely messages this week. People saying how the podcast has helped them through tough times. So that's wonderful to know. Really wonderful to know.
Yeah, that is nice. So there's a whole chat going on about Munich, about the forthcoming film. Well, just come out, hasn't it? The Robert Harris film, Munich, Edge of War. I haven't, though I have read the book. I think I reviewed the book. I did review the book.
Goodness.
It's good, actually.
You've done so many reviews, you can't even remember what you've reviewed.
Do you know, it's a running joke in my household that I will go on holiday often with paperbacks, you know, bought sort of.
and you've reviewed it.
And then Catherine will point out on the back, it says, brilliant, yeah. Dominic Sandbrook, Sunday Times.
That doesn't mean you necessarily read it, I suppose.
No, it does mean I've read it, but it means I've read it very quickly.
Yeah.
And not sort of savouring it. And I've then forgotten it. Because if you're doing that many reviews, you do forget. Occasionally. That sort of thing that you have.
I don't review nearly as many as you.
But that sort of thing you have when you're
do 1 a week, don't you?
Well, 1 every 2 weeks, I would say.
Yeah.
But when I was about 20, I would read something that would really lodge in my mind. And then the first book that I can remember that the first sign of sort of fading faculties was when I was about 24, and I read Hugh Thomas's book on the Spanish Civil War. And I read it really, really enthusiastically. And loved it. And then about 2 weeks later, somebody said, what happened? And I realized that I actually genuinely, my knowledge was pretty much stuck where it had been before it started. So I knew Franco was involved.
But it's a complicated story, isn't it? With lots of acronyms.
It is very complicated. It's a brilliant story,
It is, but that's why I struggle with, say, the Russian Revolution.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's acronyms and people slaughtering each other.
But people
and my brain just goes into.
I think people probably. There must be people who think that about your period, though, Tom. Who think that about the Greeks or the Romans? Do you not think? Or do you think?
No acronyms.
Or do you think because it's purely,
I suppose it's SBQR, but
because it's so character based, maybe it lodges more readily in the mind than the Poom and the all the different kind of Spanish Republican groups and so on. Do you think?
I think the truth is that it's So the Roman civil wars are led by great men. I mean, that's how it's framed. It's Plutarch and biographies and things and Shakespeare plays. So it's easier to get a handle on.
Yeah, it is.
Than all these kind of anonymous, fascist or communist groups with strange names who are all fighting each other.
That's possibly true. It's interesting. Going into schools, they often find the Russian Revolution very boring. Children, school children do.
And
that's quite, and It's the one period of history that I didn't really find it boring. And it's odd because it's the one that really should be the most high octane and sort of incredibly colourful.
But you know what it is? It's a very, very superficial thing. Very superficial thing. It's also that they don't have good clothes. One of the joys of history is, I think, great costumes.
Right.
And the Russian revolutionaries are all kind of drab.
Yeah, they're very drab. Well, they're often self-consciously drab, aren't they? Because they want to look, you know.
And it's a bit like the British Army in the Second World War.
Oh, terrible clothes. Your brother must do endless podcasts about this, I imagine.
Well, it's this whole thing. The
baggy trousers and stuff.
Yes, obviously the Nazis had, you know, excellent tailoring.
Yeah.
But that they spent all their money on, you know, exquisite kind of buttons and things and ornaments, whereas the British spent it on bombs, which is why in the long run, the British won.
But the British even look ridiculous compared with the Americans, don't they? So the Americans look very sharp, and the British have their berets and their jumpers and their sort of giant trousers.
But it's the David Eddington argument.
Yeah.
We were spending it on essentials.
Yeah.
Like incendiary devices.
Well, it's certainly true that we were much more high tech. I mean, we're just turning into a brother's podcast. We should stop this. Anyway, I am looking forward to the Munich film. I think it's a brilliant idea, very salutary, given that so much of the conversation about appeasement, which is a subject we will do, is so kind of, to my mind, quite shallow. You know, Chamberlain is just a weed and Churchill is a hero. Of course, to people at the time, Chamberlain was completely the opposite.
It's had such a terrible effect on international politics, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's the analogy, actually. Andrew Preston, who came on the show to talk about Vietnam, I think he's written quite a bit about this in his sort of academic work about the Munich analogy. And the uses to which it is put, and the complete sort of the misunderstanding of what happened, and the way it's been abused. For example, obviously, most famously in the lead up to the Iraq War, where the British press,
but also Suez,
same thing.
It's led Britain into its two worst international.
The extraordinary thing about Suez, actually, Tom, is that Anthony Eden, who'd been around in Munich and had been, you know, first an appeaser and then an anti-appeaser. He knew better than anybody what a bad analogy it was. And he was the key person who was pushing it, saying that Nasser was another Mussolini and we must stop him nationalizing his own canal because otherwise he'll take over all the world.
Because otherwise Hitler.
Yeah, it was exactly. It's a terrible analogy. Anyway, it's the book, Robert Harris's book, I think is jolly good. And I'm looking forward to the film. Now, what else have we got?
Barry Grogan.
Yeah.
Anyone else looking forward to the top sports action, which will be the yet unknown Rest of History World Cup? So we haven't actually discussed this, have we, what our next
World
Cup will be? I think the drama and excitement of the last one, when Athelstan came through, it's going to be hard to top that. But obviously there will be another World Cup. Amy Mantrovardi has suggested top 10 popes, Brian Kelly, World Cup of US presidents, Gnorn, worst British monarchs. I mean, I think those are all great ideas.
They are. Well, worst British monarchs would have to be very clear in the rubric whether you're voting for them because you think they're good or bad. I think the best US presidents actually is an obvious kind of, maybe it's too obvious. I don't know. That would be an interesting one. I'd suppose it would be a Lincoln Nixon final.
Well, how would Jefferson do? I mean, that would be the
or any of those founding fathers who've got, you know, had some of their domestic arrangements for now. Mm. You know, wouldn't pass muster.
I think Lincoln would win.
Yeah, I think Lincoln. Well, yeah, I think Lincoln would win. I mean, how would Donald Trump do? Maybe people would vote, kind of. You know.
Well, would he even make the cut?
We'd be the judges, wouldn't we? I probably wouldn't put him in my top 16, to be brutally honest.
No. But that is going to happen. We will be doing another World Cup at some point.
So last week's episodes, we had this sort of mammoth Rubicon, which was basically all you, Tom. Your sort of tour de force about the last days of the Roman Republic, and lots of sort of comments about that. So I loved that. Doing the Rubicon, I thought it was really, really interesting. And I think we both really enjoy those episodes where we drill down into a topic, don't we? And sort of go through the sort of narrative in great detail. So we've got one on the princes in the, well, they'll have heard the princes in the tower by now, won't they?
Yeah.
So you'll have heard the princes in the tower where we do the same thing. Splora says about Rubicon, What was wrong with the politics of the Republic that meant there was so much turmoil in its latter years? So he's saying, you know, was it the hyper-competitive nature that had served Rome so well as a small city-state? Didn't we talk? We talked about this a tiny bit, didn't we? About how, I mean, to me, you are the expert, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong. But is it not the expansion not the problem, that they've expanded so much and the system doesn't work for ruling an empire? Is that basically it?
Yeah, I think essentially. And I think, you know, as we said, I think that the key to the Republic's success was that it could channel the competitive instincts of its individual citizens in the cause of the civic good.
Yeah.
That was its great achievement. That's what enabled it, for instance, to conquer Italy. It's what enabled it to survive the death struggle with Carthage. But once it started expanding, particularly into the eastern half of the Mediterranean, which was so rich, Roman moralists said that the influx of gold from the east was corrupting. Actually, there's some truth to that. Because it did unsettle the frameworks of morality that had underpinned the political structures.
So the prizes
because
are too
people
great,
became too
basically.
Rich. Yes, people became too rich.
Do you not think as well, though, Tom? There's been a book that's come out in the last couple of weeks that's got quite a lot of coverage, particularly in America. It's about civil wars. I don't know if you've seen.
Oh yes, the one about saying that America is on the verge.
Yeah, and we talked about this way back in probably our third or fourth episode.
Yeah.
And we actually, which we recorded before the January the 6th sort of fighting at the Capitol during the sort of the meltdown at the end of the Trump presidency. And one of the things that book says and that commentators talk about, and it's always really struck me actually on my visit to America and talking to American historians and so on, is the hyper-partisanship, which is so much more intense, even than in the Remainer-Leaver thing in Britain. Just this sort of, zero-sum game, you know, any gain for the opposition is a loss for us. They are illegitimate. They are the enemy, all that sort of stuff. That just seems so pronounced in America. And I'm wondering, that obviously was the case, wasn't it, in the last days of the Roman Republic? That
except that there isn't the party system.
Yeah.
And it's much more based, I mean, you know, the triumvirate, which is this essentially kind of a stitch-up, to put the whole Republic under the shadow of these three men, Pompey, Crassus, Caesar. There was nothing unusual about that.
Right.
That's how politics operated. It was about shifting alliances between the various power brokers. But the effect of that, because it was seen as so criminal, it did become a kind of polarizing issue, what should happen to Caesar's command, that did then break the Republic.
Yeah.
And there was no room for compromise on either side. I mean, when we went through that that episode, one person we didn't mention, and it was deliberate because otherwise it would have kind of taken up too much time, was the figure of Cato.
Oh, yeah.
Who, in a way, is the kind of... He has no track record. He has no history of great magistracies. He's not a great conqueror. He has no great position of wealth. But he establishes himself as the moral conscience of the Republic, and he achieves what he achieves simply by casting himself as the moral conscience of the Republic. And of course, his enemies detest this, but there is sufficient potency in that he's able to become a massive, massive player in the political contests that structure the life of the Republic. And he plays an absolutely key role in forcing the crisis that leads Caesar to cross the Rubicon.
So he's constantly uncompromising, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think that if we come back to this period and this subject, it would be interesting to look, you know, we can do one on Cato.
Okay.
Because I think he really does reveal a lot about how the Republic functioned and how different in so many ways it is to our contemporary understanding of how politics works.
We could do Cato's in History Germany. We could do Clouzot's manservant.
Yeah, we could. Well, so, there are two Cato's, of course. There's also the one that forces the destruction of Carthage in the Third Punic War.
So we've got a couple of quick questions, which were a podcast in themselves, but they're fun to ask anyway. Mike Mackay, what would have happened to the Republic if Caesar had not been assassinated at the Ides of March? How long would the Republic have lasted? Presumably your answer is not long.
Well, so Caesar was planning to leave for Parthia. That was his plan. He had a kind of mad Alexander the Great type you know, scheme for what he wanted to do. And I think basically he'd given up on the Republic. It was too big a challenge even for him. And in the wake of his assassination, Cicero says, you know, if even Caesar with all his talent couldn't work it out, who are we to try and work it out? Yeah. If Caesar hadn't been assassinated, he would have gone on campaign to Parthia. He'd have probably made a good fist of it. He might have died there. The whole thing would, I mean, who knows?
But the person who does work it out, in the sense that he says he's restoring the glories and virtues of the past while creating an entirely new system, is Augustus. The kingfish, like many other listeners, I have to say, says, I find Augustus to be a much more interesting character than Caesar. I'm more awed by what Augustus accomplished and how he did it. I know I'm in the minority there. Not with me, because I think Augustus is an absolutely astounding figure. And somebody on Twitter, I know we're not allowed to mention non-club members, but somebody on Twitter said, you know, isn't it the case that you admire Julius Caesar when you're 18 and, you know, mm-hmm. you don't think anything of Augustus, and then when you're 38, you think Augustus is clearly the man.
Augustus is the most remarkable political figure certainly in Western history. I mean, he is such a titanic figure. So we're going to be talking about the fall of the Roman Empire. What's astonishing is that it doesn't fall then, because there's a kind of inherently fissiparous quality to Rome's empire, in that it's split between the Greek speaking half and what will become the Latin speaking half. And what you see with Pompey and Caesar, where Caesar takes over Rome and Italy, and Pompey is drawing on the east, but then definitely with Antony and Cleopatra against the man who will become Augustus, and again Vespasian, Vitellius in AD 69, and right the way through, that fracture line is just waiting to split, and Augustus's achievement is essentially to heal it and to set it on sufficient foundations that it will last for centuries and centuries.
Yeah.
And it's an astounding feat.
Especially if you think that the empire in the east lasts till 1453.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing about Augustus, Tom, I know we don't want to turn our bonus episodes into an episode about Augustus, but in the second lot of episodes, it was about 1922, and one of the themes of that was about the fall of David Lloyd George in Britain, a very showy, flamboyant, you know, man of great man. And the man who really brings him down, Stanley Baldwin, a man whose appeal lies in the fact that he's deliberately not a great man. And that he's modest and unassuming and a family man and all this sort of thing. And Augustus is, in to some extent, isn't he? Do you not think he's the epitome of that political
style?
The
Stanley Baldwin of...
Well, he's that political style, which
is...
But his modesty, he eats, you know...
He's not modest. He's not modest.
But the modesty, modesty, Tom. Do you know what I mean? The sort of showing off, I'd like to give up my offices now.
Yeah.
I'm just the first citizen. I'm an ordinary Republican.
But the thing is, we're blunt. So Augustus... Yeah. I mean, it literally means halfway to divine.
Right.
And his names, I mean, these are not titles. Imperator, victorious general, son of a god, halfway to divine. This is not in any way a modest man.
But Tom, is it not the case that he's operating in a different system, in a different, you know, in a different landscape? And therefore, obviously, there are going to be, he's going to take on these names and he's going to do all those things. But his instinct is to downplay, to soften or to muffle. I don't know.
He does not want to end up dead. He does not want to end up assassinated. He knows that that's the risk. He knows that he cannot rule without the Senate. So therefore, his strategy is essentially to pretend he's not as powerful as he is, and the Senate will pretend to be more powerful than it is. And everyone knows that that's the game. But there's no question as to Augustus's dominance. It's veiled, ostensibly, but everyone knows.
But veiling power is often the most, it's such a potent political trick.
Absolutely. But he's not Stanley Baldwin.
Well, obviously he's not Stanley Baldwin. I mean, it's an absurd comparison. But you know what I mean? It's that instinct. If you've ever met politicians, you know that there are some who are kind of bumptious and are desperate for attention. And they're kind of me, and they're always wanting to push themselves forward and to have all eyes on them and everybody conscious of their spectacular talents and all this kind of thing. And there are other politicians, part of the game, part of the appeal, is precisely what you say about veiling the...
I think more than that, Augustus is absolute genius, and I can't think of any political figure who has ever rivaled this, was his ability to play to different audiences.
Yeah.
So the whole son of a god, halfway to divine, victorious general stuff, that plays to the Roman sense that a great man should be a great man, halfway to the divine, and Augustus will become a god, and his cult will become the fastest growing cult, you know, of the first century AD. It's important that if he's going to rule the world, he does that, and he does it brilliantly. It's important, if the senators are not going to murder him in the Senate House, that he affect the role of a constitutional magistrate, just one of the lads, one of the senators. He does that brilliantly. You know, he behaves with his fellow senators as though he is just a senator, and he behaves with the people as though he's one of the lads. So he wears a kind of battered sun hat, and he likes watching boxing. And he's rather than Caesar, who in the arena when gladiators are fighting, you know, does his correspondence. Augustus kind of, you know, it's equivalent of Tony Blair kicking the football around with Kevin Keegan. It's that kind of stuff. He's brilliant at doing everything. He appeals to every conceivable constituency. And that's why he's able to draw in all those kind of different political traditions that the Republic had embodied. And he embodies them all. He, in a sense, he comes to embody the Republic, and that's his genius. And there's going to be so much to talk about when we come to our episodes on Augustus.
Yeah. Let's move on to last week's bonus episode, Tom. We must have talked about Zulu. I feel like I talk about Zulu all the time. Phil32 said, on the subject of cancellation of Zulu, I would say that while the story is told very much from the British Defenders' point of view, the film is respectful to the Zulus and makes clear they're not just savages on the warpath.
Yeah,
I completely agree with that. I think actually most, I feel like I might have written a column about this. I think Zulu might once have been, I think Zulu might once have been cancelled by some cinema, and I wrote a really
in
furious,
Brighton, I would imagine.
Yeah, I wrote some really furious column about the death of, you know, Western civilization, and what this, and the cancellation of Zulu being part of that. So we also had an extraordinary thing. Tim Vasby Burney, one of the many
top
vicar followers.
Yeah,
top vicar, I think we often call him. Shrewsbury vicar, of course. So
Definitely
obviously
a top
man. He posted some chick tracts. I don't know if you checked these out on the Discord. Have you seen these on the Discord, Tom?
Well, we didn't know what they were, did we?
I did. I had no idea what they were.
And, well, they were quite something.
They were absolutely terrifying, weren't they? So these are kind of comics that are, they're anti-Catholic. Yeah, anti-Catholic comics that must have circulated in evangelical circles. I was going to say a few years ago, but they're probably pretty current. I don't know.
Were they from the 90s, I think, the ones that were posted?
Yeah. The trouble is there's a terribly thin dividing line between those chick tracts, which I think are quite unsettling, and sort of playtime conversation in my household with the Playmobil and Lego forces drawn up to reenact the 30 Years' War.
I know. I don't think so, Dominic.
Which I think is completely normal parental
completely
behavior.
Normal behavior. No, I think you're fine on that. We also had a kind of discussion of good and evil.
Yeah. This isn't just about accents and banter. It's about very profound themes.
And killing dogs and eunuchs and things.
Yeah.
So Andy C., fascinated by this general topic, good and evil, and the way in which the concept of good and evil as opposed to absolutes is not the automatic way to imagine morality, but had to be invented, and our temptation to find Satan analogues in, say, Hades or Seth are doomed to fail because these entities don't represent evil but death or chaos, which aren't exactly the same. Am I right in saying that Zoroastrianism isn't exactly good against evil either? I think it is pretty much good.
You think it is?
Yeah, pretty much.
Is it not order and disorder? Have I got that right?
Yeah, it is. We can do an episode on Zoroastrianism. I saw on Discord that there was quite a lot of enthusiasm for that.
Yeah, I'd be all right for that. And Ali Ansari would be a good man for that, wouldn't he?
Don't need him. Got me.
Oh, Tom.
Got me. Because, do you know, I think of all the topics that I've studied, trying to make sense of the history of Zoroastrianism was the toughest gig. And it basically took me two books to do, and I did it in the wrong way around. Because when I wrote Persian Fire, I had to work out, you know, the question is, were the Achaemenid king of kings? Were they Zoroastrian? Was Cyrus Zoroastrian? Was Darius the Great Zoroastrian, or Xerxes? And the confusion over it was so intense. There was such a kind of range of opinion on it. And then when I wrote the book on late antiquity in the Shadow of the Sword, and that the Sasanian Empire, which again, I think we should have talked program on the Sasanian Empire, late Persian Empire. And I realized that they weren't Zoroastrian, because the idea of Zoroastrianism didn't exist until...
So is that made up and then, you know, retrospectively fitted?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I wish I'd done it the other way around, because it would have saved me a lot of effort and stress when I was researching Persian Fire.
I mean, is that not surely just with a lot of ancient religions, they have retrospectively been kind of codified, and the inconsistencies ironed out and have been turned into an ism in a way that they weren't, frankly?
It's part of what's also going on with Constantine and Christianity in the Roman Empire. It's the relationship of would-be global empires to understanding of the divine that kind of provides sanction for those empires.
Okay.
That I think is what's happening. And then Islam, of course, also feeds into that. So we can look at that.
So the other thing about evil, we had another vicar, Barney de Berry. I don't think we've featured him before. Barney de Berry says, I'm a vicar who believes and preaches good and evil, but of course I can do that because I believe in objective truth and a source of objective truth and morality. Well, I think that's fair enough. I remember Richard Dawkins being asked whether he could say the Holocaust was evil, and he replied, no, he could say he didn't like it, but not that it was evil. Richard Dawkins, yeah, never afraid of controversy.
I think that's honest of Dawkins.
I think it is a reasonable point, actually. And I would say, so we, I think I mentioned this when I went onto the Discord, that, you know, Ian Kershaw, the biographer of Hitler, said in our interview with him that he didn't think it was any point in saying this is evil, that's evil, Hitler's evil, because he didn't think it was a historically useful tool. And I would say, personally, I completely agree with him. I think it's the kind of thing that you do say among yourselves, so as a kind of personal moral judgment. But as a historian, I would argue it's kind of pointless, actually.
Well,
I don't think it gets you anywhere.
I've been having kind of a similar discussion, because I gave a talk in which I said that to believe in human rights requires as much a leap of faith as believing in the resurrection of Jesus.
Right.
The question of whether human rights have an objective existence or whether...
Yeah, because the idea of human rights was created, right? Yes, I mean, it didn't spring into life fully formed.
And you guess where it came from.
Well, I mean, obviously it came from, I mean, I don't think that's a controversial point, Tom.
Oh, it is, Dominic. Oh, it is. It's a massively controversial point. We should do an episode on that as well.
Okay.
Because it's really interesting, because it shows that agnostics, secularists, atheists cling to their myths absolutely as much as Christians or Muslims or believers in a kind of supernatural order do. There are so many who are absolutely appalled at the idea that the idea of human rights emerged in 12th century Catholic Italy. But we should do that as well. Right, 1922 and the birth of modernity. Rich Turner, fascinating for drawing together of many threads, literary and political. Very good, Rich. Agree with that. Thank you. This is for you, Dominic. I hadn't realised Drummond was so overtly fascistic, anti-communist. Excuse my possible naivety, but is Baden Powell similarly motivated in his scouting for boys, ahem, or does that massively predate all this?
Well, that's a brilliant question. I think I did reply to it on the Discord, but just for people who didn't listen. Obviously, when you read Bulldog Drummond now, particularly that book, The Black Gang, which is the second one, about the vigilante group, they dress up in black, they beat up communists and Bolsheviks, and frankly, we didn't go into this in the main episode, but there's a bit quite early on where there are two Jewish guys and they beat them up as well. You know, they're part of the, and they sort of, they're described by the text as the kind of two Hebrews or something, and it's all pretty
because the anti-Semitism of these kind of adventure stories, it's there in John Buchan as well.
Agatha Christie is the classic one that people often bring up, the early Agatha Christie's. So there's a book called The Secret Adversary, which I was going to talk about, also published in 1922. And that, you know, there's a very fine line between that and the Bulldog Drummond on the idea of a Bolshevik conspiracy. It's always got the same kind of people involved in it. There's an Irishman, a German, an American, and a Jewish financier or something. And the anti-Semitism is really,
very strong.
Extremely fashionable in the 1910s and 1920s, particularly in the 1920s, to bang on about Jewish financiers and Bolsheviks and Wall Street finance and all this sort of stuff. So Baden-Powell has a lot of the same themes as the 20s stuff. So Baden-Powell in Scouting for Boys, which is Edwardian, which is something like 1908, I think, he talks about he's worried about the degeneracy of the race, about cities being corrupting and having kind of sapped people's manliness, all this sort of stuff. It doesn't quite have the edge, obviously, that the 20s stuff has.
He kind of was sympathetic to Nazism. And then kind of changed his mind, didn't he?
Which is quite common. I mean, it's quite, people famously go through kind of Churchill's enormous output of speeches and columns and find bits where he says, Signor Mussolini, a very great man, in 1922 or something.
Yeah.
There's that fantastic impersonation again. So that stuff is, people who are, let's say, on the more sort of, are they on? I mean, Churchill's not necessarily on the more conservative wing in the spectrum at that stage, but people who are given the interventionist, great man, activist, manliness side of
dressing up in uniforms and going out into woods.
But everybody is actually kind of dressing stuff. Up. I mean, this is a really interesting thing about early 20th century politics and life. Everybody is joining clubs and societies and dressing up in uniforms. So there are left wing ones, there are right wing ones, there are kind of folkish kind of groups that are doing it.
Well, that was a big thing, wasn't it, in England, that they'd kind of come over and plant trees in the shape of swastikas and things.
There are all these kind of woodland
environmentally
folk
friendly,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, the Kibbo Kift and these sort of little groups of, and it's all about sort of, a lot of it is a kind of reaction to modernity in the city and all this stuff. The Scouting for Boys, I think it doesn't make sense to see the Boy Scouts are not, they're not really proto-fascist. They're
but
part
were,
of the general...
Were they not on the list of people to be suppressed if the Nazis had conquered
Britain? The Nazis, they were indeed, of course, because they were obviously...
They were seen as a paramilitary.
Yeah, they're seen as a patriotic paramilitary group. I mean, I think what's fascinating about the early 20s is how much paramilitary politics and culture... Mm. There's so much parading and dressing up in uniforms, but there's also so much kind of looking for internal enemies and stuff, which is where Agatha Christie and Bulldog Drummond and all these people come in. I mean, to me, it doesn't make them unreadable because I don't look for sanctity in what I read. But obviously some people now think, they're dreadful and should be cast out. I mean, I read the book. I remember my prep school headmaster. This says so much about the British education system in the 1980s. He came into the dorm when I was about 12 or 13, saw me reading Bulldog Drummond. He said, this is absolutely splendid. I've got lots of these myself. I'll give you more of them. He obviously thought this was absolutely reasonable to be reading in 1984 or something.
Right. So not the kind of thing that the average headmaster would be doing now. In the episode, we missed out on the bigger story of 1922, which Phil 32 alerted us to, which is that in 1922, a gentleman called Charles Osborne in the US started hiccuping and continued to do so for the next 68 years. The hiccups started when he attempted to weigh a pig. He stopped hiccuping in the February of 1990, but passed away a year later.
It is awful when you start hiccuping. It's very embarrassing.
I know, but for 68 years.
Well, the lesson for that is never weigh a pig, basically.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Warnings from history.
Yeah. Now, Liam Boyd, he asked a question that rather undermined the point of the entire choice of subject. Yes. He said, the question of whether 1922 will still be considered important in 2122 is interesting, because I'm not sure that 1922 is considered important in the public consciousness, even today.
It isn't, but that's why you need top history podcasts.
I think Liam is absolutely right. It's not considered. It's not a landmark year to most people, partly because it's considered a landmark year to people who like kind of high modernism, isn't it?
It is, and people who've got to do an anniversary podcast.
Right. We didn't have to do an anniversary. We didn't do one for 2021.
No, but you suggested it, and I thought it was an excellent idea.
Yeah. Well, I just thought 1922
and it was fun,
loads
and I
happened.
Enjoyed it. And we haven't actually, it's a kind, because I think part of the fun of doing the podcast is that you explore new formats, you explore new ways of doing it.
Yeah.
And actually, the idea of looking at, a single year and seeing what was going on in that year, I think it's a good one.
It's quite fun, isn't it?
Yeah, it is fun.
Well, because otherwise, I think when we think about all the different formats we do, sometimes we drill down and we do a narrative. Sometimes we do a very vague sort of subject, golden ages or good and evil type subjects, or we do a character. But actually, the more different kind of formats, it's more fun for us and probably more fun for the audience. They should let us know on the Discord what kind of formats they like and which they don't. Don't let us know which you don't. Just let us know what you do.
Exactly. Well, on that rallying cry.
We have one last thing, Tom. Did you see this?
What was that?
Yeah, we do. No. So look, I mean, I don't wish to, I would never say that any listeners are my favorite, but I think there are two listeners who just seem to be all over the Discord, who are never not on the Discord posting witticisms. And one is Amy Mantravardi, who clearly never sleeps. And the other is Mary Kirk Alves. So Mary Kirk Alves wrote a review of the 1922 part two episode. Did you see this, Tom?
No.
She gave it 4 stars.
Oh, good. That's more than you got in Edinburgh.
She says, in the years to come, the hosts of The Rest is History will regale dinner guests of their opening to the 1922 podcast. They will tell of the booming certitude, the steadfast sincerity, the captivating range of elocution, of the palpable sense of the speaker on the verge of cracking himself up. 1922 is a complex topic about conflict between the sense of a lost world and the means of dealing with it, between old and new, cohesion and fracture, hope and pessimism. Middle-aged prime ministers and trainers roundly convey the authority of the stakes. On the podcast generally, acting styles from Neeson to Dylan to Margaret Thatcher work mightily to bring about intellectual cohesion. A powerful performance from today's central character of Winston Churchill was so moving as to throw one car-driving listener off balance and nearly into a ditch. If such top-notch entertainment continues, the programme may need to give warning labels. The not very old conflict between coddling and integrity looms. The hosts, with their well-honed accents, will no doubt be called away to do countless animated biopics. But not, I venture, Paddington.
Brilliant review. That's very an good. Excellent review.
We can't improve on that, really,
no,
can we?
No. Thank you. Thank you for that.
So that set the bar very high for 4 stars. So if any listener can do better, we look forward to it.
It inspires us to aim for that. That 5-star review.
It does. Yeah, it's good to keep us on our toes. Right. We will see you all next week. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for your comments. Keep them coming. Get your bingo cards at the ready for what have we got coming up, Tom? We've got
History of Railways.
Railways. General Gordon.
We've got General Gordon. We've got Disease.
Yeah, lots of fun
stuff.
All the fun of the fair. Right. Yes. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
I don't know why I'm waving because they can't see.